Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Turn the Page podcast from Syosset Library, and our guest today is, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Kiku Hughes. I'm a comic artist from Seattle, Washington, and my debut book is a graphic novel called Displacement.
It is so good. I was just before we started recording, I was telling Kiku that I just finished it last night, and it was absolutely so well done. For our listeners, would you like to just talk a little bit about what the book is about? It's autobiographical, but it's got more to it than that.
Yeah, Displacement is a book about a fictionalized teenage version of myself being pulled back in time to experience Japanese-American incarceration alongside my grandmother, who was a teenager in San Francisco in 1942 when she was forcibly removed with her family to first Tanforan Assembly Center in San Bruno and then Topaz Relocation Center in Delta, Utah. So it's a story about fictional Kiku sort of discovering for the first time her family's history and sort of uncovering these stories that were never really told to her or fully explored in her family through the mechanism of time/memory travel, and sort of how she learns about the lasting impacts of this, you know, big community trauma that her grandmother was a part of, and then sort of links back to current events. The book takes place in 2016, weaves them all together in that.
It was really well done. It definitely made me cry. I don't know if I mentioned that before we started talking, if I mentioned it already when we started talking, but it really was so good. First of all, I have to say the way that you portray emotion in your characters, just like through facial expression, is just beautiful. You know, like you could just sort of you could really feel the melancholy, the anxiety, the uncertainty, just everything was just so well done. It just hit me in the heart over and over again. Another thing, and this is just something when you first begin the story of fictional Kiku and her mother are exploring San Francisco, Japan town, which I believe was where her grandmother had lived. And you end up in, instead of the houses that she lived in, you end up in a mall, which I've been to. I've been to that mall. It's been a really long time, but I've been to that mall and explored some of the stores there. So it was a really interesting thing opening this book and being like, oh, I know exactly where they are. I'm like, oh, you know, my friends who live in San Francisco have told me that it's not as like a bustling of a place as it was last time I was there, but I had no idea that there were homes there that were torn down. So that was like a big knock on the head for me.
Yeah, thanks. That was based on a real story, a real situation that happened. My mom and I, the first time I visited San Francisco, were sort of trying to find this address that we had written down somewhere that my grandmother and her parents had lived in, and one of those really beautiful old San Francisco row houses. Yeah. That made up a lot of Japantown. And I don't know exactly when it was torn down, but yeah, we did end up in a mall, and it was, yeah, not very busy. So we were just kind of like, I don't know what to do now. But it is interesting because, yeah, I've talked to other people, other Nikkei Japanese Americans who, you know, were born and raised in Japantown in San Francisco. And that mall is such a huge part of their, you know, experience growing up. To me, it was kind of just like, oh, now it's, you know, a mall, which feels very American in its way.
and sort of disjointed, not attached to anything, even though, and it, you know, it, like I said, it's been a really long time since I was there. One of the things, I mean, you know, I'm white and I was there as a tourist and, you know, but I liked, you know, it had like, it was like almost like it was circular and there were little ramen stalls and it was definitely different than the malls that, say, I'm used to. It certainly seemed to, you know, be sort of trying to root itself in the culture that the area was, I guess, founded in, but just finding out that there were beautiful row houses there that were demolished for the mall is definitely the American experience. Yeah. So from there is, I believe, when Fictional Kiku gets her first experience with the displacement. She or you are sort of, there's smoke, there's fog, which is pointed out that there's always fog in San Francisco. So if the fog is what's going to tell you that this is when the displacement is going to happen, it's difficult to tell if it's just regular San Francisco fog or magical fog. But it's, you know, what I liked about it was you have the story of Kiku going into this, you know, being very much American. You mentioned several times that there isn't, you know, there wasn't that much connection to your family's Japanese heritage. I don't know if that was fictionalized or if that was, you know, true so much for your experience, but it just these little snippets of here's Kiku coming in and seeing the roots of internment, incarceration taking hold, you know, through signs or through other things around. And then right next to Kiku is Ernestina, her or your grandmother, who was a violinist. And even though the stories run parallel, you don't necessarily interact with her on a one-to-one basis. And that was just really well done. But I guess what I want to ask is what made you make that decision that Kiku was going to live this story, you know, have her own experiences, and Ernestina was going to be touching it emotionally and maybe just very peripherally near you or Kiku, but not interacting?
Yeah, the main reason that I decided not to have one-on-one dialogue interaction was just because I never met my grandmother. She died before I was born, and I didn't feel like I could give her an authentic voice, especially given that, you know, my mom would be reading it, my mom's siblings would be reading it. It was something where I didn't want to feel like I was putting words into my grandmother's mouth that didn't seem authentic. And in that way, it was sort of, yeah, kind of just sort of respecting her memory by not trying to create a fictional version of her. But I think it also was, it's part of the story, this sort of distance that you have from these parts of your history that you can't necessarily access directly. And I think in that way, it also really becomes part of the narrative that, you know, Kiku is trying to work up the courage or ability to speak to her grandmother in the past, even at one point sort of chasing her down, but never quite being able to reach it. And I feel like that really is just kind of a metaphor for how I felt about researching the book. There are just some aspects of specifically my grandmother's life that I'll never be able to know. And yeah, I feel like as frustrating as that is for me and for the reader, I think it is an authentic experience of trying to track down these histories. you can't it always get.
It was great. It was really great. I can't think of a story, a time travel story, which involves intergenerational, where there isn't even like a little bit of interaction. And I loved it for that. I'm not saying that the others are bad, but it was just sort of a refreshing look at that. And I really think what you had said, it resonates, because I hadn't even thought of that, that, you know, her experiences were her own, and you were researching her, but the connection was sort of severed by several things.
Thank you.
Oh no, you're welcome. It was good. There was a lot that I didn't know about internment that I learned from reading the book. So just for those who might not know, so different terms that are used, there's Nikkei, there's Issei, and there's Nisei?
Yeah, so Nikkei is just the term for Japanese diaspora, people of Japanese descent, no matter where they went, who are living outside of Japan. Issei is first generation, which is the first group of immigrants from Japan, people born in Japan but who immigrated. And Nisei, second generation, which is what my grandmother was. Then there's Sansei, third generation, my mom, and Yonsei, fourth generation, that's me. So,
So another thing that I learned was basically, and it's, I mean, no matter what, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. But there was a point where somebody asks Kiku, do you belong here? And the question that came to my mind was, is he asking if she belongs in this time? There was a moment that I was wondering if it was someone else having a displacement. or, you know, does Kiku belong in this line? Because she is clearly, you know, has mixed heritage. So one of the things that is mentioned is that, like, you were incarcerated if you had like 1/16th Japanese heritage in your background, which, again, it doesn't matter what percentage it is, but it's a statistic I don't think a lot of people know. And I hate to say, sometimes I don't hate to say it, it's true, sometimes people don't really consider the big picture until it might be something they could relate to themselves. How, you know, like, hey, like, this affected, these people were American. There was no case at all of anybody within who were incarcerated who had been spies or anything.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that statistic, the 1/16th Japanese blood, is that it was very calculated, because there were only, you know, so Japanese immigrants had only been in America for however long. There would never be anybody with less than 1/16th blood, no matter how many generations or whatever. It was very calculated, just to be like, if you have any amount, it didn't really matter. The 1/16th was arbitrary. It was picked because they knew that would cover everybody. The other thing I learned that I wasn't able to really put in the book, but was kind of a terrifying fact, was that some people were put in camp that didn't even know that they were Japanese, or that they had any Japanese heritage. Kids who had been put up for adoption, maybe adopted by a non-Japanese family, that didn't know, but the government knew.
Wow, so, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, so they would just be taken away from this family that they knew, into a situation that they had no context for. Yeah.
Another thing was the questionnaire that young Japanese people were given, I believe, when they were turning 17 in the camps, which was basically, I mean, trying to get them to enlist in the army to fight for a country that basically put them in jail for not being American enough. And there was was it questions 27 and 28? So what were those questions? And then there's the yes, yes people and the no, no people and what that meant in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, so the loyalty questionnaire was actually given to everyone, every adult, so everyone 17 plus.
Okay.
It was really framed as a way to get people out of the camps faster by checking and just making sure that we know which ones of you are loyal and which ones of you aren't. And we'll do this so that, you know, everybody who is loyal can be sort of expedited out of camp. So isn't that great? Great for you. But the questions were, it was a series of questions that included ones like what, list your hobbies, list what magazines you subscribe to, what organizations have you given money to, etc. It is kind of funny reading back because I don't know what they expected people to write, like, I'm giving money to spies for Japan organizations, like
I mean thinking about it now, you know, like I just think of a bunch of and of course circumstances are different, a bunch of teenagers like trolling them, like, well but of course that was a long time ago, even though history unfortunately sometimes repeats itself, but you know, exactly, like, what exactly were you supposed to say?
Yeah,
in that, you know, like, I am absolutely disloyal. Like, that's not going to work well for you. And then if you were loyal, like, were you really going to be expedited out? Like, who are you supposed to trust? You just had everything taken from you. And then you're being told, asked if you're loyal.
Yeah.
It's just mind boggling.
It is a really weird, it's a bizarre form to read. But yeah, so questions 27 and 28 were very controversial because 27, and I always get them mixed up, but one of them, I think it was 27, asked if you were willing to volunteer for the army, or if you were a woman, you could volunteer for the Women's Corps. And 28 asked if you were willing to denounce your allegiance to the Emperor of Japan. And so 27 presented a problem for a lot of young men who were saying, you know, why should we enlist in the army when we're locked up and our families are locked up? Like, what are we fighting for? And, or, you know, even people who just didn't want to go fight and die in the war. And 28 was an even bigger problem because Nisei, people who had been born in America especially, and plenty of Issei as well, had no allegiance to the Emperor of Japan, so they couldn't renounce it. And a lot of people were worried that this was kind of like a gotcha moment, where if they said, yes, I renounce my allegiance, the government would say, ha, so you did have an allegiance, we knew it. So it was kind of a lose-lose for a lot of people, not sure how to answer that one. So the administration eventually sort of tried to clarify and say, just answer yes and it's fine. So you know, people like my family said, yes, I renounce my loyalty to the emperor. But there were lots of people who saw that as a very, as a racist question, as it was. So they would answer no, no, and were called no-no boys by some people. And I grew up sort of hearing about the no-no boys as kind of troublemakers, or as people who were, you know, making waves or not, you know, going along with what they should have been doing. But there was so much more to that aspect, or to sort of the various answers that people gave. And it was really interesting to find out the different dimensions of what that looked like.
It was, again, I mean, it was not something that I'd known about, and it really did feel like, you know, damned if you do and damned if you don't, and it was very complex, because I believe fictional Kiku had a friend who had, you know, and she was a great character, who was very, like, answered no, no, but then at the same time, Kiku said she answered yes, yes, and her friend was like, I understand. Like, it's complex. It's not an easy situation to be in because there's unknowns on either end.
Yeah, and I think part of the journey of researching for this book was sort of going from thinking, growing up knowing that, or hearing that no-no boys were troublemakers, to researching a little bit more and being like, well, why did my family not say no-no? It seems like that's obvious, you should say no. To sort of then realizing, you know, everything that was at stake and the ways in which people really tried to protect their families, tried to protect themselves from this really sort of unknown danger or very present danger. And sort of, yeah, the way that you can't really, summarize there was one right thing to do at that moment. It really depended on sort of what was at stake. And everyone had something at stake, but I can't really fault anybody for what they chose to do.
No, because at one point there's a family that Kihu rooms with that their father has had everything taken away from him and is trying to prove his loyalty, and it's not going well, and everything is at stake. Literally everything is at stake. So another thing that I didn't know was, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, incarceration was aimed at the Japanese population on the West Coast. It didn't happen on the East Coast.
Yes, that's correct.
That, I mean, the fact that it happened at all is crazy, but what?
Yeah, I guess the thinking was that there wasn't a way for people on the East Coast or even within the interior of America to contact Japan. There was something known as the exclusion zone, which was this big area carved up, I don't know how many miles inland from the West Coast. That was sort of, this whole area is where people are dangerous, and west or east of that was not considered a threat. So there were smaller populations of Japanese Americans living in like New York, Philadelphia, that didn't have to go to camp. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I think we do forget very easily that, you know, cell phones were not around forever and, you know, but that was, again, that was something that I did not know. Were those families who lived in New York, were they able to sponsor any of their families or anyone that they knew on the West Coast to get them out?
Sometimes, yeah. And I believe some of it is still kind of unclear for me, but I believe that is how my grandmother was able to leave camp. She was able to apply to college and she got accepted to Juilliard, and she was able to stay with a Japanese American in New York, who I believe she met through her church. So I think there were some people who were definitely able to sponsor and help people get out a little bit earlier. But there was also, I think, kind of a cultural divide at that point. And I believe I mentioned this in the book, but now I can't remember. But that after leaving camp, my grandmother moved to New York, went to school, and that was where my mom and her family was raised. And they went to a Japanese American church in New York. And the members of that congregation, not all of them had gone to camp, of course, because some of them were from the East Coast. And in the 60s, when there was sort of talk of opening camps for political dissidents, for communists and Black Panthers, etc., some of the Japanese Americans who were from the East Coast said, oh, that's a great idea. And my grandmother apparently stood up and said, you have no idea what you're talking about. You didn't have to go through this. It's not a great idea, which was kind of one of the only times my mom had ever heard her really talk about camp in a very public way. I think that created sort of a divide within the Nikkei community at that point. Was just another lasting effect of sort of incarceration scattering a community in ways that are kind of irreparable.
Another thing you bring up towards the end of the book, and there's a lot in this, and I want everybody who's listening to read it. I don't want to give away too much about just sort of how the stories weave together, because experiencing it is so worth the read and the look. The art is beautiful, the story is beautiful. So you also mention just a little bit about how race was sort of used against other races, like the Japanese. You know, people would say, oh, well, the Japanese, they were, you know, they were put in internment camps and they didn't complain, you know, they're model immigrants, or is that the term?
Model minorities.
Okay. Yeah. Which is, I think, something that a lot of people don't really think about just when they think about how various races are regarded through the generations and the ages.
Yeah. The model minority myth really sort of came about in the 60s, I believe, early 60s, late 50s. Which was sort of, you know, camp had happened, you know, within the last decade or so. And people were kind of reestablishing themselves, but there was this idea that was put forth mainly to undermine the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
That was saying, you know, Asian Americans, Japanese Americans are, you know, just being very peaceful and going along with everything. Why do you Black Americans not, you know, do that too, which is something that I think some Asian Americans still to this day kind of utilize in their own ways because of ingrained anti-Blackness within the Asian American community, without realizing sort of the history of what the model minority myth represents as a bludgeoning tool to, you know, squash other people. It's not a compliment. It is a means of dividing a community that should be, you know, woven together, fighting side by side. So obviously that, and what I had grown up knowing is that my mom had always told me, you know, the model minority myth was sort of saying that, like, Asians are getting rich in America, they're all smart and rich. And my mom grew up in the projects in North Manhattan. She was like, we were not the model minority that they were talking about. My mom was like, she dropped out of college. She, you know, grew up in the projects. It was like, the model minority is not a real concept. It doesn't represent every Asian American. And it really is just a tool to use against Black Americans at the time. And even today, sort of. Yeah.
I thought that was definitely something that I hadn't considered or heard about before, but have definitely seen. And I guess to say that I hadn't heard about it is sort of incorrect. Maybe not in those words, but sort of in the roundabout way that people talk about different races and different minorities in this country. Exactly.
Of like, Asians are good at math, or yeah, sort of like Japanese businessman stereotypes, like,
yeah,
like these things that are very ubiquitous in this country, but all are sort of used as a weapon within a very specific context that you don't necessarily see on the surface.
Exactly. And it was a really good that whole narrative is introduced towards the end of the book when Kiku and her mother reunite and just discuss their experiences. And it was just a really good way to sort of dovetail the story of this was the 1940s, which really was not that long ago. I know people like to think it was ages ago, but it wasn't. And there's a lot of things that were not ages ago that I think everybody is realizing are extremely current. You know, like, you really have to know your history or it's very easy for it to repeat itself. So it was a good way to sort of close out the story and just sort of shine a light on just the complex relationships that America has with basically everybody who has emigrated here So I really, it was such a good book.
Oh, thank you. It definitely is. There's a lot of complexity that I'm sure I wasn't able to capture fully, but there is so much to unpack with that whole history.
Is there anything you are working on now that you would like to tell us about?
I don't know how much I can talk about it just yet.
The answer yes would be enough.
Yes.
Yay! Exciting.
It will probably never look exactly the same as Displacement, because this was kind of a story that was very unique in that it's, you know, a story that I've grown up hearing and wanted to sort of talk about and learn about for a really long time, and everything else after this is not going to be that.
But it would be nice to, I am looking forward to more stories and more art from you as well. Yeah. I would say Displacement, I would say it's good for, personally, I would say grades 3 and up, but I know everybody is different.
It's listed as 12 plus, I believe. But yeah, of course there are plenty of precocious third graders.
I mean, you know, to be honest, like even like we see kids in fourth grade reading The Hunger Games, and this is much less violent and, you know, teaches history. So, I mean, if my kids were in third grade, I would have no problem giving it to them and speaking about it with them in context. But of course, as I always tell parents when I'm in the children's room, if you have any questions about whether or not this is appropriate for your child, read it yourself and then decide. Anyway, thank you very much, Kiku. This has been wonderful, and we're excited to have you on Celebrity Drawful on October 8th, this will be our third Celebrity Drawful. We've done... we did one in May, we did one in August. This will be the Inktober edition, and you will be drawing with two other artists who are actually Mexican artists, and they are dating. So that should be...
They're going to have an advantage.
Well, you know, it's not a competition, though. That's the thing. It's like, it's more like, let's have fun and be goofy about our artwork and talk to fans of, you know, or prospective readers. So I always try to say that. I'm like, this is not in any way a competition. This is just a way to have fun and sort of reach out to the community and connect with people on another way. So once again, this was Jessica, and our guest was...
I am Kiku Hughes.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Thank you.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.